Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Fell Into Food Podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell. My guest today, Maddie Heyman. She is a PhD-trained ocean scientist turned food product co-founder and mom. Maddie left academia to help build Pacha, a two-ingredient sprouted buckwheat brand rooted in regenerative agriculture and radical ingredient simplicity. She now speaks candidly about career pivots, identity shifts, mental load, and building a life and business that actually feel sustainable. So Maddie, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So you've got a pretty wild resume: civil engineering, oceanography PhD, art installations, Burning Man, and now bread. So my first question, when you look back, what's the common thread that connects all of that?
Yeah, definitely for me, I've always been guided by a connection to the earth and wanting to care for the planet. I grew up in the Midwest, so I didn't have a ton of education in the realm of climate science. It was kind of like we learned about global warming in like sophomore year of high school, and then kind of, you know. And it was always something that piqued my attention. And I went into civil engineering in part because my grandfather was a civil engineer, but also because I knew that civil engineering was like the engineering that most impacted the public. And yeah, and just kind of as I moved through the different phases of my life, I realized like, okay, I want to work on climate science. Okay, I want to work on climate solutions. And part of the reason that I pivoted into food was because as I was studying for my PhD, I realized that we know a lot about climate science. Actually, like there's still so much to learn, but we know enough to be making changes that we are not making. And so I wanted to be part of a solution. Yeah.
Awesome. Was there a version of yourself that didn't make it through that transition? You know, what did you have to leave behind going from academia over to food?
Yeah. So this was another part of my identity. Like as a young person, I just envisioned myself being in a job, like working a position and being with my family in the evenings and kind of like having that rhythm that's more like, just 9 to 5. because that's what my parents did. And most of the people in my life that I was exposed to as a young person were not entrepreneurs. And when I met my husband, both of his parents actually are entrepreneurs of their own kind. And he just like had a totally different mindset about the marriage of work and life that happens when you are an entrepreneur. It's like there's not a separation between the two in the way that there is when you're, you know, at work versus at home.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I left behind. And I would say it was like a growth for me that felt like, oh, I don't have to just work the jobs that like other people are making and creating out in the world. Like I can actually create the world that I want by running my own business.
Did it change your sense of self-worth? I was the same way, going like the same thing, thinking 9 to 5, corporate job, come home. But you know, you did all that and then you stepped away. So how did that change your sense of self-worth after you left it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I haven't thought about that. I would definitely say that my sense of self-worth has it's gone up dramatically. I mean, like full disclosure, I, as a student, And into grad school, I actually had like a very severe eating disorder. And I think a lot of that was kind of linked to feeling like a little bit purposeless and a little bit, just like it was easy to hide. And so I did, like I just hid parts of myself from other people and, becoming a business owner and becoming a mom, has really shifted the way that I feel like every single thing I do is important. Like every single thing I do has an impact on my family, my community, and my businesses that I'm running. So it's just like, there's no more like, working for somebody else, working at, in a job where you're like, well, like I can kind of not be working right now and it doesn't really matter. Like someone will do this stuff. It's like, nope, I'm the one who's got to do it. And like, it really makes me feel like every moment of my time is valuable.
It so is. And the accountability on yourself that you put, again, having some very similar, and now it's, if I don't provide or work or put in systems until you could get a business big enough, it's all on you at the end of the day. And that's, you know, I know that's what you guys are working on is building this brand. But during your time in academia, like, was there a specific time moment that you just knew that you were going to jump into like creating a brand or go into food, or was it just kind of a slow drift along the path?
I like kind of both.
Okay.
So I would say that there was a time, it was probably about 3 years into my tenure as a PhD student. So about halfway. And I was just looking at the path before me, like, okay, what it is to be a scientist and be in academia and be a professor or a researcher or, primary investigator. And I was just like, I don't really think this is like the thing for me. And I don't know what the thing is. And at that same time, I was also like investigating going into more like a communication, science communications, or something at the intersection of art and science, which was like a lot of my Burning Man experience was related to that art science intersection. But then like I, as far as starting a food brand, it kind of crept up on me. So our brand, we started in 2020, with some of the planning, like the initial phases of getting together the founding team, in 2019. And Adam and I, my co-founder, Adam Heiner, we were maybe a year into our relationship, which is like a little bit early, in my opinion, to like jump off the cliff and start a brand together.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
You know, why not? Hey. And so it was kind of like we were baking the bread in our community house, and the bread had like changed my life or my relationship to bread format food. Like, it was the only kind of bread I could eat, and it feels amazing. And it was like, yeah, it just had done such amazing things for me, that when Adam started working on, okay, I'm going to like, he had founded multiple other brands, including Boochcraft, which is his most recent project. And he had kind of hired himself out of positions and was like, all right, I'm going to do the next thing. And people were asking us to make the bread for events and for their person, you know, like, hey, can you make me a loaf? Like, I'll buy it from you. And it just felt like the world was asking for this bread to come forward. And he was at a moment where he was like, okay, I'm ready to take on another project. And I think I'm going to do this bread. I wasn't like in the very initial stages of planning, but I was working my job. At that point, I was a postdoc. I was working for the Navy, actually, like doing like classified submarine research. And like, I'm not super aligned with my values. I don't know. And at some point, I was standing in my kitchen with him, and like, I don't even know like what the larger context of the conversation was, but I just kind of like, I remember like just blurting out, like, I want to work on the bread. I want to do this with you. And I kind of, it like kind of took me off guard. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's true. I want to do that. And it is really aligned with where I want my energy to go in my life. And it was scary. It was also like, holy crap. Like I just got a PhD. I just spent all this time learning this thing that has nothing to do with bread. Okay. Or starting a CPG business. Like, yeah. But that moment kind of, it happened. And Adam also thought that it was a little early to start a brand with his girlfriend. But yeah, he also was like, I think in that moment could feel the trust of just like, I think I can't say no to her.
But yeah. I feel like all the training, all the academia, I feel like that teaches you like to get ready, right? Because it teaches structure and that things have to get done. It just is that inner gut feeling of this isn't right. This isn't where I'm supposed to be. And it takes some time to find what that is. I went through that same progression of I hit this position, I hit that position, and I was like, is this it? Is this all I'm meant to do for the next 30, 40 years? I was like, I don't think I could do that for another 40 years. And you really start to turn the wheels of what's going to make me feel fulfilled and want to continue to have a purpose, you know, through everything, you know, with the name Pacha, you know, what does that name mean and why does that feel right for this brand?
Yeah. So we, the name Pacha comes from South America. The person who originally gave us the recipe, which has changed dramatically since he handed it off to us, he's from Argentina. And the Pacha comes from the Incan language. And essentially, like, it means, like, everything that exists, like, everything that creates our reality, but a more simplistic way of looking at that is like our earth, like everything that we have here on our planet. And for us, for me, starting the CPG brand, like my reason for starting the CPG brand was not because I was like, oh, I'm going to make a bunch of money, like selling a product. I was on board because our mission is totally to help farmers transition to regenerative practices. So like to be able to sequester carbon and help with water cycles and water retention and build healthy ecosystems through our farmland and our farming practices and just like returning to a way of stewarding the planet so that the planet can be here for us and can continue to be like Pacha for us. A fun fact though, later down the line, I actually did a podcast interview with somebody who's from India and he asked me, do you know what Pacha means in Sanskrit? And I was like, no. And he was like, oh, I totally thought that you would know this because it's just crazy. It means to digest.
Really?
Yeah, which is just wild because like, as I mentioned, like I couldn't eat any other type of gluten-free bread before Adam shared this recipe with me. And it is like, it is just, it's sprouted, it's fermented. It's like, it feels so good in the gut. It really is truly like the most digestible food. And yeah, it was just like, wow, okay, I guess we picked the right name. Like,
It's funny how things, again, the universe has a way of coming back around to tell you that it almost validates the decision that you made, or even with little things of naming, it can always be starting a brand. What is the name and what is the logo and what are, you know, all the corporate-y type stuff that you kind of have to have, you want to have, but in reality, you just want to create and build. But if you don't put some of that foundation down the road, it turns into a nightmare because now to scale and to get a brand out to actually make a business out of it can be very, very difficult. Let's talk about a little bit about it. It's fermented buckwheat and sea salt, which to me, when I saw that, I was like, well, how are they making bread out of that. So maybe let's talk about the fermentation processes. I'm big, I mean, more on the meat side, but I do a lot of fermentation, aging. But how does it pertain with buckwheat? And how does a recipe evolve when there's two ingredients?
Yeah. Well, so the recipe actually, the original recipe had sunflower, flax, and buckwheat. And the people who were making it were also doing like, they were more like seasoned breads. So they had like a caraway bread and they had like an herb bread. So it almost felt more like a meal when you ate. Like I'm going to compare it to meatloaf, which is a terrible comparison to make, but like just kind of that vibe of like, wow, this is like, this could be like the main part of my meal here. So we ended up evolving it. We thought in the beginning, we thought that you needed the flax as the binder. Cause there's so many like gluten-free or vegan recipes that use flax as like a binding agent. And, during COVID, we were having just supply chain issues were rampant. And so we were doing some testing and some researching just to see if it would be possible to simplify our supply chain. Nice. We realized that the buckwheat itself is itself binding. So it makes that same kind of like mucilaginous compound that the flax makes that will hold things together. We always fermented it like from the beginning. It was always a sourdough, but it's a wild yeast. We actually don't add any cultured yeast to our product because we use whole buckwheat groats. The first thing we do is we soak and sprout the buckwheat, just like not a lot of sprout. You don't want a lot of sprout, otherwise it tastes like grass. Don't do that. And then that gets blended. So the groats themselves have wild yeast on them that accomplish the fermentation. I don't think you can do that. I think one of the things that happens when you grind any grain into a flour is that it makes it like the ecosystem that those yeast are living in is too dramatically shifted for them to survive in the same numbers. So using the whole groat is key. So then we ferment for 24 hours we ferment from somewhere between 12 to 24 hours, depending on the temperature in our facility. And then we bake and we has this amazing like nutty sourdough flavor.
What else? Yeah, I got some samples of it. And the first thing I noticed, the texture was spot on, which that was probably the most surprising thing to me, because usually it's the texture that is one of the most difficult things to kind of really dial in. And I was like, wow, this really has like I don't want to use the word dense. It had the right consistency. I don't know how else to explain it when I tried it. And I was like, wow, this is interesting and different than what I was expecting. I was not expecting what I got out of it. And then reading it, it was like, toast it, you know, do like a double toast on it. So I did that. And again, just it held shape, held together. I don't know. It really just surprised me when I got it. And the other thing that I noticed was, and this is probably going to go back into the sustainability piece of it, but the container that it's in is cardboard. The little tie around the to keep it closed is cardboard. Like, one, talk about that. And how do you even, I don't know, how does that even function on a day-to-day basis, knowing that it's made out of like that type of I'm assuming a recycled material?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So actually all of our packaging is 100% home compostable. So, the clip and the tray that the bread are in are also recyclable, which you could also throw them in your compost. The compostable packaging, that's another, it's just like a foundational piece of our business where we were like, if we're going to start a CPG brand, one of the biggest issues with packaged goods is waste and just like wrappers and plastic and multi-layer foils going into our landfills. And we were like, we don't really want to be a part of that. So we have a commitment to use like the the very best, like the cutting edge of compostable technology that we can use for our product. One thing that makes it possible, I think, for us to use that compostable film is that our bread actually is different and has a higher moisture content than like most white breads, or like glutinous breads, or even gluten-free breads that are trying to mimic white breads. It has a higher moisture content, so it actually is like kind of good for the bread to breathe a little bit. It lasts longer once you open the package up, and that, you know, one of the challenges with compostable films is that they don't have like a airtight vapor layer most of the time. So products that are trying to stay crispy, like crackers, they can get stale in compostable packaging. But our bread, it just works.
Yeah, it was just a really cool like touch of your whole story as I started digging in, that you're living, breathing it, and putting it to all facets of the product, not just the thing that you're eating, but every piece that touches it. Back, you said like COVID was kind of a nightmare, and I know you guys were pointed like kind of grocery retail. You know, walk me through what you guys had to do to pivot, like what that looks like from the inside.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, COVID time. So we started in like a 300 square foot test kitchen, and we had signed the lease for that space before the COVID thing started happening. So we were on the hook, and we were like, all right. In some ways, starting in COVID was good because all the problems were just there from the beginning rather than not being there and then all of a sudden having all this wild change to like interrupt the train that was moving down the tracks. So just like, oh, okay, I guess we're climbing a mountain, let's build a different train. In the beginning, what was most challenging was that we were intending to go into retail, and I mean, we're a frozen bread brand, like, you know, not exactly the ideal product for shipping out in a direct consumer fashion. But we, at the time, like a lot of the buyers in the grocery stores were just not reviewing the doors. Like they had so many things to deal with that they just kept pushing their reviews back. I think the other thing we ran into is that the reviews that we did submit for, we weren't slicing our bread. In part because of our size, like it was just like we didn't have the equipment to slice the bread. And so we would send it out as whole loaves. People would thaw it and slice it themselves. And the grocery buyers were just like, I don't understand this. So what ended up happening was that we had a friend of ours who had a lot of experience with e-commerce. I think he sold like green screens or something. So not food, but e-commerce in general. And he was like, this might sound weird, but I think that your product is like different enough, and like there's a dispersed but dedicated customer pool that's available, and I think it could work for e-commerce. And so we were like, well, it's not working for retail, so let's give it a shot. Why not? That's what ended up happening. We launched our Shopify website in, I think, 2022, early 2022, and grew from, you know, a couple thousand dollars in a month up to, I think our peak was like 220,000 a month.
Wow.
Grew our primary customer base. Like we had a lot of exposure just through running Meta ads, and people found our brand and wanted allergen-free gluten bread that was made from real food.
Yeah, it's you'd be surprised how many people need, because of dietary restrictions, or want it for their lifestyle. And then you go and you try to find the options, but everyone has, I hate to say it, corporatized a lot of the things that are supposed to be healthy for you. And no longer, you know, you look at the ingredients and you're like, hey, wait, that now has like four more things. I won't mention a brand that just sold, but there's been claims of products that are, you know, they look at it and they're like, this was originally five ingredients. Now it's nine. And there's other things. And if you know anything about food, those are fillers. They're there to cheapen the product, make it easier to produce, longer preservatives. Keep the shelf life longer. And so it just makes it hard to keep something going when again, it gets corporatized in that space. You know, did the customers, the amount of customers and that loyalty base, did that allow you then to, you're in Whole Foods, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did that, was the need for it so heavy that you were able to like approach a Whole Foods and be like, you need to have this? And then like, what does that look like? And what do you have to be willing to like give up to get that shelf space at a Whole Foods?
Yeah. Well, actually, with Whole Foods, what happened, it did definitely help that we had a brand, and we, like, in our conversation with the buyer, we were like, yeah, you know, we're selling like $100,000 worth of bread a month online. Like, people do want this. But the thing actually that sold us to Whole Foods was our compostable packaging.
Really?
Yeah. We had a meeting. I mean, most brands will go region by region, right? Like, they'll like open up California and like, and do kind of a slow rollout of the brand. We went straight to global. And in our meeting with the buyer who said yes to Pacha, you know, we spent 10 minutes talking about the compostable packaging, and she was like, well, like, all right, so like, lay it out for me. I have, you know, 10 other brands in my frozen bread set who say that they can't do compostable packaging, and yet here you are and you say it works, and like, so what's what's the deal here? And yeah, so we went through like how it's all working and what we're doing, and the compostable packaging is more expensive, and like, yeah, it's, if you're gonna change your packaging over from traditional like petrol-based plastic to bio-based, like, you're gonna eat away your margin, and most brands are not able or not willing to do that, but because it was just something that was built into our brand DNA, like, we are just figuring out how to make it work with that. And the Whole Foods buyer was like, this is what we need brands to be doing, and so yeah, I'm bringing you in.
And you also had said that getting into it, you, the original goal wasn't to make a bazillion dollars, right? So I think you already had that pre, like, in your back of your head, like, I'm not here to become a billionaire. So my margins, you're willing to stick to who you are, the roots of what the brand was and what you're trying to accomplish, more so than just, I hate to say, let's increase our margins. Let's really do what's right. And then ultimately led you to Whole Foods. Because if you didn't, you probably wouldn't have gotten into the deal, right? If you weren't who you guys were.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, it's like, yeah, it's not that we don't want to, like, we do want to build a healthy business that's like profitable and that someone would want to buy. Like, we want the business to be healthy. At the same time, it feels like it's a long game. And like, for me, I see that what is needed from CPG in order for CPG and our like national scale food system to survive is like, yeah, like, we have to move towards sustainable regenerative practices. Like, otherwise it's just going to collapse. And I think that the consumer awareness, like, in this very moment, having compostable packaging and regenerative ingredients is like a nice bonus. It's not what is changing consumer behavior right now. And I believe that in the future, like, it's going to be the thing that makes or breaks brands. And I think that as people learn more and as people are just looking out at the world and realizing like, holy crap, like, we're going to enter another Dust Bowl. Like, this is where we're going. Having a brand that's already rooted in doing what's right is going to, it does create that consumer loyalty and the, like, that long game of this brand is built to survive what's coming for us.
How do we prevent the word regenerative becoming another buzzword? Because I also work with a farm in that space. They're on the beef side, but they do it the right way. Like I said, water conservation, soil conservation, carbon sequestering, like, those, they actually do it right. And I'm so afraid that it's going to get commercialized and that you're going to have to pay for that term, like a lot of other things that, oh, it's organic or it's this. And when you look at some of the practices, you're like, well, that's great, but you're really not doing a whole lot. You pay a lot of money for a term. So how do we keep the word regenerative, what it actually is and means, and not into a corporate or paid term?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question, because like on the one hand, it's like, okay, if we come up with like a really good definition of what regenerative has to be, and then we regulate around that, it gets to that similar situation with organic, where it's like, okay, it's highly regulated. People are, in some ways, like, in order to meet the standards, they do things that are actually not as good for the soil, right, or the ecosystem, because they're like, well, if we're going to be organic, we have to do it this way. So you want to avoid that. At the same time, yeah, you want to avoid the situation where it's just like completely greenwashed, where like, yeah, people say a natural, like, oh, this is natural. Like, that doesn't mean shit. but, and at the same, at like, there's all of the definitions and regulation side of things. And then there's also just like the real need for farmers to be able to make the transition, like now, like a year ago, ideally, actually 10 years ago. And, you know, I think for a lot of farmers, 99% of the farmland in the United States is not organic. So to have organic as a baseline for regenerative, one, I don't really think is the right thing because of what organic actually is. But it, you know, it just prevents 99% of farmers from even having the ability to start working towards farming, like, practices that are better for the planet. One of the biggest dangers, or like the biggest, yeah, one of the cesspools that I can see or foresee happening would be around like pesticide use and the term regenerative. Like, right now, since it's unregulated, you can still use pesticides on a regenerative farm. Like a farm that's doing 99% of the practices and like not tilling, not rotating animals into the field. They're taking care of the soil, but then at the end of the season, they can spray pesticides. And I think that particular practice is one that will really erode consumer trust in the term regenerative. So to answer your question, I don't have the answer. I don't think anybody actually has the answer to your question. What I would say is that, like, it feels really important that the term regenerative not be so narrowly defined that farmers can't do the right thing to wiggle around and meet a standard. And at the same time, like, I think there are some really important pieces that should be required for a regenerative certification. For one, I would think that like pesticide and herbicide use should be disallowed for any kind of regenerative certification. And then the other piece is like on the side of the retailers, there are retailers right now who are very selective and I wanted to say discerning. They review closely any verbiage around regenerative language. So like at Whole Foods, for example, you have to have one of the qualifying certification standards in order to put the word regenerative on the front of your pack. And then any language that's on any side of your packaging that refers to regenerative is reviewed by a team for approval. So having retailers as gatekeepers is actually like a really, really, really good thing, because any brand that wants to get on the shelves at Whole Foods has to be impeccable with their packaging. But other brands, like there are other, I don't really think we're in danger of this at this very moment, but there are other brands who are probably not targeting Whole Foods as one of their first customers. Like they're going straight to Target or Walmart, who don't have those same review standards. And I think that's where we could run into problems where, like, okay, there's a, I don't know, let's just say, like, Pepsi is going to launch a healthy soda, and they're just going to slap the word regenerative on it and sell it to every 7-Eleven in the country. And then people are starting to be like, oh, regenerative, oh, what is this? What is this thing? And they're associating it with something that's, like, not healthy, not good for the planet.
Yeah, it's going to start to take away from what the whole practice and purpose is supposed to be. I think that is a right step. I didn't know that they had, like, a review committee. And I think it allows for the farmer or the person trying to build the brand to really, like, pitch their case. Like, here's what we're doing. Here's where we're at. And here's what we're continuing to do, because you can't just, like, flip the switch overnight and just go 100% regenerative. You know, especially if you already have a farm and some of your practices, it takes time to build the soil up and those crop covers and the way that you're doing it. And it takes a little bit of science. Well, not a little bit, a lot of bit of science to do that and understand it, to allow the soil to get better. Okay, what do you need to plant to actually pull carbon? What is your product that you're harvesting? What are the negatives that are coming from that product, right? So if you think of, like, cattle belching and farting, you know, that's all you hear is methane. It's like, well, how do we actually reduce those amounts? You know, so farmers are actually introducing red kelp into their diet because it actually helps with just the natural thing. So it's little things like that. It's like, you're never going to make a cow not fart or not burp, but how do we put a practice in place that starts to reduce the negatives of the practices that are the negatives that happen with agriculture as a whole? And I don't know, maybe it does give some leeway to some of these brands to start wanting to, because maybe, you know, a review team says, hey, if you can get this and this in place, then we can start at knowing that you're going to end here, but have, like, a, I don't know, some sort of timeline that says by this point you have to, otherwise we're going to pull your product, because then it forces the farmer or the brand, the CPG brand, to actually hold true to what they say. You know, how many times did you hear, oh, we have this standard in place and we'll be there by 2030. And then 2030 hits and they're like, we pushed that goal to 2040. And it just keeps going and going and going, because there's no actual accountability from anyone. And I hate to say it, the consumer at the end of the day in today's world is, they're just trying to survive. They want to put food on the table for their kids and or their family. And it just makes it really, really hard sometimes. But I do like hearing that there's committees or groups, because, again, I don't want it to become a commercialized term that you hear again, like eggs. You know, you hear free range, pasture raised, you know, and it's like, what do these terms even mean? And then you get to scale, and then what does pasture raise even mean? That they have access to a pasture, but doesn't mean they even actually go into a pasture. And it versus a farmer, let's say an Amish farmer, who he calls them free range, but you know they're probably doing a better job of letting those chickens kind of just roam and be free. And yes, they may have to supplement some of the diet, because, you know, when you have that many chickens, they're just going to eat up the ground, and you got to have a lot of land to do that. So they may need to supplement in other ways that is still not terrible. But that's my soapbox on it. And I just want to get your kind of thoughts on that whole regenerative buzzword at this point.
Yeah, totally.
Kind of shifting over to, like, back to, like, the business side, you know, you said you founded your business with your partner. You know, what is running a business, founding a business with your partner look like, you know, especially when it's been a hard day and there's the business side and there's the personal side?
Yeah. Well, I will just say, like, my husband is amazing. And we've both done a lot of personal work. One of the most foundational pieces of us being able to function as a founder couple is that we when something is happening, when there's something going wrong or not as planned, or just that doesn't feel good, the inclination is to first reflect on how we are contributing to that, like, rather than first being like, oh my God, Adam's doing this thing, like, I'm so annoyed, to first reflect on my piece and whether it is actually something that I just need to resolve within myself. And he does the same. And then if it is actually something that, like, it's like, actually, no, it didn't feel good that this happened, then we actually like we set up a container to address that specifically, not just like in like a random meeting, you know, like when we meet, we have very clear like boundaries and containers for the types of conversations that we're having. I would like to say that we have like really clear boundaries and containers around all talk about business, but that is not true. Oh yeah, driving out to the desert, talking about work. Yes, that's happening for sure. The other piece I think is just like we have a lot of trust that the other one is really, really capable. And so that if they are doing something, there's a good reason for it. Like neither one of us is just doing things without having some forethought and some thought about like what the implications of our actions could be. So yeah, a lot of trust and a lot of self-reflection. Mm-hmm. It's really supportive in that journey. But aside from that, I love working with my husband. Like he is so capable and yeah, we both definitely have a go-getter temperament and like we just have a lot of capacity to like make things happen and look at timelines and make sure that everything is on course. And so, yeah, it helps that we're not like really, really different in how we approach things.
Yeah, that could make things a little difficult if there was a very, you know, black and white on the spectrum of getting decisions done. You know, you talk openly about, you know, mental load and decision fatigue. You know, what's the one thing that finally broke the cycle for you or at least made it more manageable?
Oh, yeah. Got like a really good answer for this. I recently started calendaring my to-dos, which means that I have a to-do list, which I've always had, and it is never going to get done. And yeah. The thing is, I now call that a to-be-scheduled list. And once a week, I go into my calendar and my to-do list, and I prioritize the most important things that need to be done. And I put them, I time block them. And I say, I think this is going to take an hour, and I'm going to do it at this time. And my whole week is planned out, including like when I'm cooking, when I'm driving, when I'm going to appointments, when I'm having meetings, when I'm going to meditate in the morning. Like it's all in my calendar. And people look at it and they're like, oh my God, like shoot me. That looks so overwhelming. And I'm like, it looks overwhelming. But the thing is now I don't have to think about what I should be doing. Mm-hmm. I made a plan for myself and I just need to execute it. And that like the stress of going in and looking at that infinite to-do list 50 times a day, like it gets to you. And it has lightened my mental load. So much. It's so helpful. And I would recommend it to anyone who is running any type of business. Especially a high.
How do you handle though when shit happens, right? Life happens, stuff happens. How do you handle though when you have time blocks set for certain things and something that has to be addressed comes up? Does it just go kind of back to the top of the priority list and then gets rescheduled?
Or you just move the time block.
You just move the time block. I didn't know
it happened, so I'm just gonna move it. And if I need to like move it into the next week when I reprioritize my weekly thing, I will. You know, the plan can change and it does frequently. But it's just it's like having those things in my calendar and at all times being like, okay, the plan is laid out. And not needing to go into that to-do list.
And how well do you handle, you know, keeping distractions out, because I know that's one thing that pops up for me, and it's something I've been trying to work on, is something comes through, or, you know, the phone goes off and you try to keep it put away, or if you put it on do not disturb, you know, how well can you keep yourself staying on task and not being distracted from things that are just noise?
Yeah. I mean, again, like, I feel like the calendaring piece helps with that, because it's like I have things in my calendar that are like respond to emails and text messages. Like, so when I always have my phone on do not disturb, unless I'm like expecting an important call that's not coming at a specific time. Always on do not disturb. And then, like, yeah, if I notice something that comes through on my phone, I'm like, cool, I'll get to that. And yeah, I think I used to feel like I had to look at my text messages as soon as they came through, because it was like, what's priority right now? Maybe this text message is priority. And then it was just so easy to get distracted by that. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I'm like, I can look at my calendar and I'm like, oh, this thing I'm supposed to be doing, right, that's priority. I'm going to do that, rather than look at what's coming through on my phone, because I have a different time that I'm going to do that.
It makes total sense. It's just something that I still struggle with, trying to, again, my last previous, you know, corporate life was always like at the needs and the mercies of whoever needed something. And I felt like that was my worth. And like, if I don't respond, even though I, you know, when you look back, it's like, that wasn't important, or that wasn't a do or die. And there were times where there was other really pressing things, and it was like that just had to kind of get pushed off, and then it either resolved itself or it really wasn't that big of a deal. But it's just something that I think a lot of people struggle with, that both corporate and, you know, people who have their own businesses, of not being distracted, because there's just so many ways in today's society to get distracted on anything, you know, family, life, whatever it is. But staying focused on what you need to get done, it's been difficult when it's so easy to get distracted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a couple kind of final questions. Maddie, what are you most afraid of getting wrong?
I mean, yeah, I guess like the thing that comes up for me is just like, I'm afraid that we are wrong about how we can grow the business and the strategy that we're, you know, like whether the strategy that we are pursuing is actually the one that's going to make the business totally successful. Because, yeah, there's worlds where it could just fail, and all the farmers that are growing buckwheat for us, and like all the supply chain that we've built is just like, oh, okay, well, that's not happening anymore. So, and yeah, I'm worried. I am worried about choosing the right strategy. I'm worried that I'm going to get it wrong.
Great answer. Where's Pacha headed? And what do you need the food world to understand about what you're building?
Yeah, Pacha is headed deeply into the natural channel, like full penetration of those who are shopping at your natural stores, your Sprouts, your Whole Foods, your independents. And then, like, we have a few products that we are planning to launch into conventional. And I think what we need the food world to understand about what we are offering is that it's real food, and it, like, we are designing a product that meets the needs of American consumers as its primary objective, right? Yeah, and I think the other thing that I need the food world to realize is that, I just need people to realize in general, is that some of the problems that they're experiencing in their body are related to their diets. They're figuring it out. So,
I think AI is helping slowly. People, if they put in their medical history, it's starting to uncover some stuff for people, and they realize, oh, you mean if I didn't drink Coke every day that I wouldn't feel a certain way? Yeah, you probably wouldn't. I mean, people tell me all the time, like, well, what do you eat? And they tell me, and I'm like, well, I could tell you probably right now why you feel the way you feel, and the times that you eat and your sleep cycle, like all the just physiological things and biological things of a person's body. It's just fascinating to me, because I'm like very strict with, like, 7 o'clock, I don't want to eat, because I'm in bed by 9:30. So I need my body to be able to process and digest. My caffeine consumption is cut off by 1 p.m. because I know if I have something, and it slips time to time, if I have something at 3 or 4, forget about the sleep cycle, because my circadian rhythm is completely thrown off.
Totally.
And it's just crazy when you can stick to something, you can start to actually tell what is affecting you by just the simple insert. It's kind of like what a lot of moms do, right? When they're trying to figure out if their kid has a natural reaction, you know, when they're feeding. Well, you slowly introduce, you pull all out, and then you slowly introduce, and then you figure out what is causing them to react a certain way or be fussy. And I think if an adult would take a little bit more time to kind of food journal, if you will, and really analyze what they're eating, they would be hard pressed to figure out what's going on, and then they wouldn't need necessarily medications and treatments that everyone thinks they need to be on. So it's crazy.
Yeah. Levels, like, you can heal your body if you're putting the right things into it. Like, yeah, you have the ability.
Yeah, it's right there. It's at your fingertips. It's what you select. You guys are launching tortillas, correct? Or they already currently out?
That's correct. They should. Yep. They hit the shelves in West Coast Target Supercenters like last week. Yeah. And they will be hitting the shelves at Mom's on the East Coast. And we're working on getting other accounts to carry the tortillas ASAP.
And are those in the frozen section too? Because I'm assuming it's very similar.
No, those would ideally be in the refrigerated set. Most natural food stores have like a refrigerated tortilla selection, so they would be in there. Every once in a while, they put those in the frozen section. Like, their whole tortilla set is in the frozen section. Well, the velocities are not great. refrigerated section.
Awesome. Love it. I want to be able to get some of those, because I would love to be able – I'm a tortilla freak, so tortillas are my jam.
Oh, they're so good too. We added psyllium husk to the tortillas. So those are buckwheat, sea salt, and psyllium husk, which is like an amazing fiber supplement. But it also just like it create like makes them so pliable and durable. Like it's not quite the stretch factor of a gluten tortilla, but like they're hearty, and the flavor is just amazing. I mean, you've had the bread, so. You know, it's similar, but like a nutty sourdough, they're so good.
Awesome. Maddie, where do people go? Hit them up with all the socials if they want to check out what you guys are doing.
Yeah. You can follow us on Instagram at livpacha. And then our website, you can purchase product and read more about our company, livpacha.com. And yeah, those are the best places.
Awesome. Maddie, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on. I know as a busy founder and mom trying to get through the day, to take some time out to have this conversation isn't always the easiest. So I really appreciate you taking that time. And for everybody listening, we'll put all this into the show notes, where to find the products, all those great things. Because as I said, I did get a chance to try it myself, and it will surprise you. Let me just say that. It will surprise you. So we'll put all that show notes, and be sure to always like, follow, subscribe, all those great things for the podcast. And until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.